Well, good afternoon, everyone. Can you all hear me all right? Everybody out there in internet land as well, I hope? Good, good. All right, let's see. I'm going to do Alt Tab, I'm told. There it is. Am I sharing now? I'm good. Oh, am I? Okay. See, this is technology. Good thing we have the. Am I on Zoom? Oh, let's see. So now I'm on Zoom, and now I share screen. Bingo. How's that? I think we're there. All right. Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you, as it always is a pleasure to be with brothers and sisters, because of the precious things that we have in common, the great hope that we're going to be thinking about as we read the book of Micah. And I always find that whatever book I'm currently studying is my favorite book of the Bible. I heartily recommend, I know we're probably from various ecclesias, in your ecclesial life, if you don't have a Bible class, get one going. And when you do have a Bible class, do a book at a time and force yourself to go through each chapter. Because there's chapters like maybe like the one we just read, Micah chapter 3, that you read it and you think, ooh, that's kind of harsh. You're kind of ill at ease with it. But then when you get into it and you do some studying on it, gems turn up. And I have a gem for you in this class. I hope you'll enjoy it as much as I do. On Micah chapter 3. But as we come to the prophecy of Micah, you know, I suppose our first thought might be that it's a little bit of less familiar territory to us than other passages, other books of the Bible. Just like my screen. Oh, there we are. I don't know how I did that. But is it really unfamiliar territory? We might remember Herod the Great of cursed memory, and how that he demanded of the leaders of the Jewish people, where would this Messiah the wise men had been seeking, where would he be born? And in Matthew 2, it says, thus it is written by the prophet. It doesn't tell us it's Micah, but it is Micah. It's from Micah chapter 5, the prophecy of the Messiah's birthplace. We might be familiar with the words about judging between many peoples, rebuking many nations afar off, about beating swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. This is beautiful stuff. This is fundamental. This is our identity as believers in our Lord Jesus, who's going to be the king from Jerusalem. We look forward to that time. This passage might be more familiar to us as coming from the prophecy of Isaiah. If you've ever wondered about that, if you've ever noticed it, say, well, why is it in both places? I think I have an answer for that. I have a suggested answer anyway. We'll get to that in the second class. So there's a couple of familiar passages. One maybe less familiar is that Jesus refers to Micah. Remember, he says a man's enemies will be those of his own household. He was warning of his disciples of persecutions that were to come, saying he was sending them out like sheep among wolves. And he quotes Micah 7, verses 5 to 6. In fact, Micah 7 has a context which is so apt for Jesus' time that Brother Harry Whitaker described it as, quote, a tremendously powerful messianic prophecy. So the man whose words we're going to be considering this afternoon and tomorrow, God willing, he lived and prophesied in relative obscurity more than 2,700 years ago in a time and circumstances far different from our own. But his words speak to us with tremendous relevance. His book reveals to us the character of a jealous God, a God revealed in awesome majesty, whose fury is going to be directed at oppressors and venal men, like we read about in chapter 3. And at the same time, Micah reveals God as caring, and concerned for the poor of his people that have suffered at the hands of wicked leaders. And to those poor of God's people, and to us as well, Micah describes the future blessings of a time when every man will sit beneath his vine and fig tree, and when none will make them afraid. Perhaps the most well-known passage from Micah is in Micah 6, verses 6 to 8, when the prophet says, "How can I come before God? What's the acceptable means? Shall I bring thousands of rivers of oil? What can I bring to make myself presentable before God?" And we have the wonderful response that the Lord requires for us to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with him. So these words force us to examine our hearts, to examine our standing before the Lord. So that section we're going to do for Sunday school tomorrow, God willing. So we have kind of a feast of fat things before us. And what I hope in this study is that we'll come away not only having looked at familiar passages, but having seen them in the context of the book. I want to think about the context of the book, both internally and also its context in history. And I think we'll come across some really encouraging things. So let's open our Bibles to Micah 1, verse 1. Where we see that it is the word of the Lord, which came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Now we'll come back to say a little bit more about these three particular kings, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, because they're really important for the background of the book. But for now, I just want to point out that he saw this vision concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. So it's a reference to the divided kingdom, to apostate Israel in the north, Judah in the south, Judah with Jerusalem as its capital, Samaria as the capital of the northern kingdom. Micah 1, verse 2. "Hear, O peoples, all of you. Listen, O earth, and all it contains, and let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. For behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. The mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will be spilt like wax before the fire, like water poured down a steep place." The prophecy begins with an awe-inspiring picture of God revealed in power, in terrible anger against Jerusalem and Samaria. "Watch," Micah says, "and you'll see the Lord coming from his place, from his temple." Verse 3 says, "He will come down." This is a really neat phrase to follow through the Old Testament about describing God as coming down. Take a second, think. Can you think of any places where it says God will come down? There's when he's investigating the wickedness of Babel, when he's investigating Sodom, both times the Lord comes down. There's when he delivers Israel from Egypt. He says, "I will come down and visit my people." There's at the declaration of his name. And here's one from Exodus chapter 19 at the giving of the law. Let me read it to you. It's Exodus 19. The section goes from verse 11 to verse 20. It says, "The Lord came down in the sight of all the people upon Mount Sinai. There were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that were in the camp trembled. And Mount Sinai was altogether in a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And the smoke of it ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount trembled greatly, and the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai. And Hebrews gives us a little detail about how Moses experienced this. Moses said, "I exceeding fear and quake." And the writer of the Hebrews reminds us that our God is a consuming fire. And I think this is the picture we have right from the beginning in the prophecy of Micah, that we can't take God's goodness and mercy for granted. We can't treat him with indifference. We have to see God in his great power. And it's remarkable when Paul starts his letter to the Romans that he's going to speak of God's great grace toward us. But first, we have to have a sense of our unworthiness. And so he speaks of the wrath of God. We're told it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. We're taught that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. We acknowledge his greatness. And in this vision that Micah starts us off with, we're left with the question, who can stand before him? Even the mountains melt at his presence, and valleys are carved out. And it's not by the slow process of erosion, but by the sudden violence of earthquake. Rocks melt like wax before the fire and pour down as a waterfall. Verse 5 tells us all this is for the rebellion of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? What is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, planting places for a vineyard. I will pour her stones down into the valley and will lay bare her foundations. Samaria had been built on a city 100 meters high. Omri built it, thinking it would be impregnable, that the rocks of its buildings would come tumbling down that hill. That prosperous city would be left as a field, nothing more than a place to perhaps plant a vineyard. And so Micah's prophecy begins with a dramatic demonstration of the power of God, the creator of the universe. We live in such an irreverent age where God's very existence is questioned, and those of us who believe in him are mocked for it. We must not allow ourselves to be infected with a casual attitude toward God, to ever forget his power, to grow complacent in our relationship with him. We need to understand why God is angry. And so it's worthwhile for us to review the time and setting of the prophet. So here's a timeline I have up on the screen. You'll see that Micah is right in, right in here. About 750 years BC, contemporary with Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. During the time of Micah, the fall of the northern kingdom occurred. He is a contemporary of Isaiah, and he's after Amos. You see how Amos comes before him? If you ever get around to doing a real detailed study of Micah, pay attention to Amos, because it's quoted all over the place. We'll only make maybe one allusion to that in these classes, but there's very strong connections between Amos and Micah. So what about these three kings, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah? Jotham's pretty good. Says he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. But if we were to give him a grade, speaking as a teacher, I think it'd have to maybe be a B plus or an A minus. Because though he was personally a good person, still the people acted corruptly, it says in the Chronicles account. And the reason of that is given to us in the Second Kings account. See how we put these things together? It's wonderful that the scriptures allow us to do. That the high places weren't taken away. The places that Solomon had set up around Jerusalem, they stayed there right until the time of Josiah. It's amazing. And people were allowed to continue acting corruptly and worshiping these false gods. So maybe B plus, A minus, he's a pretty good guy. Okay, that's the first one. Jotham, Ahaz. Oh my goodness, Ahaz, he is an absolute aberration. I mean, his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, his great-great-grandfather, they're all decent men. Ahaz did human sacrifice. He did the thing where he ransacked the temple to buy protection from his enemies. Then he used the Syrian temple to remodel the temple in Jerusalem. He was a real disaster. And even in distress, it says in Chronicles, even when God brought him down, he refused to turn to God. So it's in that time of his distress, King Ahaz became increasingly unfaithful to the Lord. This is that King Ahaz. Back when I used to teach, I had a colleague named Charlie Randall. Charlie was from New York City, and he was a typical, you know, the brash New York City kind of guy. You probably know the type. And he had a parent call up and say, "You know, how come you gave my Johnny an F?" And he said, "Because I couldn't give him a G or an H." I think for Ahaz, you'd have to give him a G or an H if you could. You'd disaster. All right, the last king for the time of Micah is Hezekiah. And he, on the other hand, is extraordinary. The way he's described in the Kings is that he clave to the Lord. It's the same word as is used in Genesis when it's talking about, "For this cause shall man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh." He was, from the first moment of his kingship, a remarkable man, a man of prayer. He did so much to restore the nation spiritually. He was there when the 185,000 Assyrians surrounded the city. And he was the one who led them. And he said to his people, with him, the Assyrian king, is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people were strengthened by the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. And at the end, it says, Hezekiah did what was good and right and true before the Lord his God. And in every work that he began in the service of the house of God, in the law and in the commandment to seek his God, he did it with all his heart. So he prospered. Wouldn't it be great if we could be described that way? You know, if we had that kind of wholehearted, and we know brothers and sisters like that, don't we? We think of brothers and sisters who do it with all their heart. And so God blesses. So for Hezekiah, I don't think we have to vote on it. I think we all give him an A+. So those are the three kings. Now it's going to be important to keep them in mind. So Jotham, we got the B+, Ahaz, the F-, and Hezekiah, A+. So that might help us as we're reading. Like we read chapter 3 just now, at the beginning, and it was pretty dire. And so you might think, well, okay, so when did that take place? And we're going to get to that. Little bit about how the book is laid out. As you go through it, there are sections that are addressed to the evil leaders. That's the problem. There's some said about idolatry. There's a little bit said about kind of quieting the prophets, the true prophets, and not paying attention to them. But more than anything, the message of Micah has to do with oppression and cruelty by leaders. And so for them, there are these repeated messages of condemnation. But interspersed with them, there are messages of hope. So I've highlighted them on the screen. We'll come back to this later on as opportunity arises. The red ones are the hopeful bits, the positive bits, the black ones, the condemnation bits. There are two audiences then. There's the oppressors, who in chapter 3, we're going to see, and the King James does this great alliterative thing. It says the princes, priests, and prophets. They, on the one hand, are condemned. And on the other hand, there is a remnant mentioned five times in the prophecy to whom words of encouragement are regularly given. Let's just have a look at chapter 2 as an example of the oppression. Now, I've skipped over a bit in chapter 1. If you want to ask a question about that, we can do that in the question period, about the end of the chapter. Brother Joe Hill, who might be online today, gave me some real good insight on this. But I'll put that aside for now. We want to get to chapter 2. Listen to how it describes these oppressors. Woe to those who scheme iniquity, who work out evil on their beds. When morning comes, they do it, for it is in the power of their hands. They covet fields and then seize them, and houses and take them away. They rob a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I am planning against this family a calamity from which you cannot remove your necks, and you will not walk haughtily, for it will be an evil time. You know, so many times when you're reading in the book of Psalms, you have David saying what he's thinking when he's laying in bed at night. I don't know if it's because I'm getting older or whatever it is, but sometimes I have trouble sleeping at night, and you wake up at night and you lay there and your mind gets filled with stuff. Maybe this doesn't happen to you, but it happens to me. and sometimes you can't sleep because of what's on your mind. And sometimes you get thinking about things that you really probably shouldn't bother with. David, his Psalm 63 is a really good example. It starts off saying that it was written when he was in the wilderness. Doesn't say which wilderness, when. Maybe it was when Saul was chasing him. Maybe it was when Absalom was chasing him. Whatever it wasn't a good circumstance that he's sleeping in the wilderness. He says, when I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. Because you have been my help, therefore in the shadow of your wings, I rejoice. And that's the way we should be thinking, right? But these guys, they're mentioned in Micah chapter 2, verse 1. They're laying awake all night, scheming. They're seeing how they can take away from other people. There's no moral restraint. It says in verse one. I'm using different versions here. I want to stick with the New King James more or less. I'll probably be going back and forth, New King James and the New American Standard 1995, another good version. But I think I'm going to use the New King James for now. Says in verse 1, at morning light, they practice it because it's in the power of their hand. Such disregard for the commandments of God. They covet. They steal. They utterly disregard the spirit of the law, which teaches love of God and love of neighbor. Love worketh no ill to one's neighbor. So their behavior was the opposite of the law. They covet and take. Later on, we're going to come across a verse in chapter 6, verse 16, where it says, the statutes of Omri are kept. All the works of Ahab's house are kept. So you think of, well, what kind of thing did Ahab do? Well, Ahab's the one. Remember when Naboth had his vineyard, the heritage of his family, his inheritance? And Ahab said, you know, I'd like to have that. And when Naboth says, well, I'm sorry, I can't do that. It's sacred. It's my inheritance. We're not allowed to do that. And Ahab says, well, but I wanted to build a vegetable garden there. And says he went home and he just laid down and he sulked and he's laying there. He's actually laying in his bed, sulking. When Jezebel comes and says, well, aren't you king in Israel? We can sort this thing out. And you know the terrible outcome, that they kill Naboth. It's that kind of person that's being spoken about here. So it's interesting. Here's an interesting translation thing. If I like New King James for this, and most versions get it right. Notice in verse 3 of Micah chapter 2, "Behold, against this family I am devising disaster." And that should connect you back to verse 1. "Woe to those who devise iniquity." So God says, okay, you're busy scheming, I'm scheming against you. You know, this, as you have sown, God says, so you will reap. It's the same word in the two places. Skip down to verse 8 of Micah 2. God says, "Lately, my people have risen up as an enemy. You pull off the robe with the garment from those who trust you as they pass by, like men returned from war. The women of my people you cast out from their pleasant houses. From their children you have taken away my glory forever. Arise, depart. This is not your rest. Because it is defiled, it shall destroy, yes, with utter destruction." So God says, they devise iniquity, I'm devising iniquity. Through oppression of the poor, the oppressors have become God's enemies. The gracious God, who always cares for the poor, remember the law about not taking a man's cloak for the night? God says, you take that poor man's cloak, he's cold at night, he'll cry to me and I'll hear him. They were absolutely heartless, these people, in their treatment of peaceful, innocent people. And even women and children are not safe from them. So, we've gone rather quickly through the first couple chapters of Micah. And so far, we've only seen these oppressors and these schemers. Now we come to chapter 3 that we had read for us. And the tone doesn't lighten here. We were skipping over one of the bits of hope that we'll come back to in a little bit. Now we come to chapter 3. And at the end of chapter 3, there is this. Her heads, her princes, that is, judge for a bribe. Her priests teach for pay, and her prophets divine for money. Yet they lean on the Lord and say, "Is not the Lord among us? No harm can come upon us." Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed like a field, Jerusalem shall become heaps of ruins, and the mountain of the temple like the bare hills of the forest. So we were working out before about the different kings. We had Jotham, who was B plus, A minus. We had Ahaz, who was horrible. And we had Hezekiah, who's really, really remarkable. So we might ask ourselves, is this a prophecy against the north or the south? And if, well, it's got to be the south because it's talking about Jerusalem. So it's got to be either Jotham, Ahaz, or Hezekiah. And which one might it be? That's what we're going to find out. And when we find it out, it really adds a big dimension to the story. So let's look a little bit at these princes and priests and prophets, these three groups that are denounced. There are the princes or rulers or heads in verses 1-3 who are the leaders. And it seems to have been a perennial Old Testament problem. They are described using language that takes the words of Amos and turns them backwards. Amos had said, "Seek good and not evil." And chapter 3, verse 2, "You who hate good and love evil." They were doing the exact opposite. So that's the princes. The prophets, verses 5-7, verse 5 says, and this is a bit of a strange verse when you read it first. It says, thus says the Lord concerning the prophets who make my people stray, who chant peace while they chew with their teeth, but who prepare war against him who puts nothing into their mouths. Here's what that's a bit odd, isn't it? Right? But what he's saying is, if you give them a little treat, you give them a cookie, you give them a piece of pizza, give them something nice to eat, they'll prophesy nice things for you. But if you don't give them a treat, you don't give them something nice, you get war. So they're prophesying they're doing it for reward. They're doing it for what they could get out of it. Pretty awful. And then rather surprisingly, in verses 6 and 7, it says, therefore you shall have night without vision, and you shall have darkness without divination. The sun shall go down on the prophets, and the day shall be dark for them. And the only way we can make sense of that is if at some point they must have been speaking for God. So these guys who are prophesying for profit, they got the profit motive, they were once God's spokesman. And they've turned from revealing his light to prophesying for money. It's pretty shocking. And it seems inescapable. God says, I'm not going to give you my word anymore because you're prophesying for money. And then finally, the prophets or the princes, skip down to verse 11, Micah chapter 3. Her heads judge for a bribe, her prophets teach for pay, and her prophets divine for money. Money, money, money. That's all that they can think of. So at verse 8, the prophet Micah speaks up. And it is Micah who's speaking here. He says in verse 1, and I said, this is Micah speaking. And then now verse 8, it's Micah speaking when he says, but truly I am full of power by the Spirit of the Lord. And he passionately denounces the bad behavior of these leaders. I am full of power by the Spirit of the Lord and of justice and might to declare to Jacob his transgression and to Israel his sin. Now hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob, rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and pervert all equity, who build up Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with iniquity, her heads judge for a bribe, priests teach her prey, her prophets divine for money, yet they lean on the Lord. This is the outrageous part. They lean on the Lord and say, is not the Lord among us? No harm can come upon us. God's on our side. We'll be all right. We can do what we please. Therefore, because of you, Micah says, Zion shall be plowed like a field. Jerusalem shall become heaps of ruins, and the mountain of the temple like the bare hills of the forest. Jerusalem's fate is described in the same way as Samaria's had in chapter 1, verse 6. The field would become heaps. So Micah 3, when did it happen? Was it Jotham, Ahaz, or Hezekiah? Anybody know? The answer is in Jeremiah chapter 26. I would have said it had to be in the time of Ahaz. And if it wasn't in the time of Ahaz, maybe Jotham. Come on over to Jeremiah chapter 26, where we'll find this surprising answer. Now, if you look at this overhead that I have here, you'll see we're moving forward, 100 and some odd years from the time of Micah to the time of Jeremiah. And this is right at the very end. This is when Judah has gone off the rails and Jeremiah is sent to the temple to make one final appeal to the nation in Jeremiah chapter 26. So Jeremiah 26, the first 7 verses describe Jeremiah being sent in the reign of Jehoiakim to stand in the court of the Lord's house, God says in verse 3, maybe they'll listen. And Jeremiah says, if you don't listen, God has said he'll make this house like Shiloh. Remember what Shiloh was? That was where Eli had the house of the Lord. You remember what happened there, right? The Philistines and all that. Because of his son's corruption and all that. God's saying, you know, straighten out. This house that Jeremiah is standing in the court now and speaking from is going to become like Shiloh. Well, that's not what the people wanted to hear. And so in verse 8, it says, when Jeremiah finished speaking all that the Lord had commanded to him to speak to all the people, the priests and the prophets and all the people seized him, saying, you must die. They're going to kill him for what he said. Why have you prophesied this way? And they ask him. So it's looking bad for Jeremiah. But as little time goes by, some cooler heads prevail. If you come down to verse 16, it says, then the officials and all the people said to the priests and to the prophets, no death sentence for this man, for he's spoken to us in the name of the Lord our God. Then some of the elders of the land rose up and spoke to all the assembly of the people, saying, Micah prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. And he spake to all the people of Judah, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, Zion will be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem will become ruins, and the mountain of the house as the high places of a forest. Did Hezekiah kill Micah? Look at verse 19. Did he not rather fear the Lord and entreat the favor of the Lord? And the Lord changed his mind about the misfortune which he had pronounced against them. We're committing a great evil against ourselves. We killed Jeremiah. We're in big trouble. We got to do like they did back in the time of Hezekiah when Micah denounced them. So now we know the backstory. If we only had Micah chapter 3 and we didn't have Jeremiah 26, we would never know that the doom pronounced by Micah there didn't happen. Because Hezekiah and the people said, you know what? Micah's got a point there. We're doing the wrong things. We got to get our act together. We got to get straightened out. And so Micah was successful. It is, I find this extraordinary. I don't know when the first time I stumbled on this, but wow, does it ever add a dimension to Micah chapter 3? Because, you know, after we read it at the beginning of class today, you might have sort of said, oh my goodness, that's just bad news. But the people responded well. Now, there's one more thing I want to say about the life of Hezekiah. And that is, when in the life of Hezekiah did this happen? So the question we want to ask ourselves is there any time in the life of Hezekiah, as recorded in the Kings and Chronicles, where God threatens punishment and then relents? And the answer is yes. The interesting thing is that it's after the cleansing of the temple. It's after the great Passover, when he went to the north and brought his brethren, that remnant. I'm telling you, brothers and sisters, we want to learn some lessons about how we treat brothers and sisters when there's problems in the ecclesia. Read what Hezekiah did in bringing people back from the north. Read about all the reluctance there was by some of the folks down south. And read about how some of the ones in the north refused, but some came. Some hadn't even prepared themselves right. And Hezekiah prayed for them. It says God heard. If we want some real strong lessons, real obvious lessons, we take them from the life of Hezekiah. It was after that. It was after he restored the priesthood. It was after the deliverance from the 185,000 Assyrians that surrounded the city. It's even after his 15-year extension of life. It's right at the end, in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. Right at the end, after describing all that those deliverances and all those blessings, says this in verse 25. But Hezekiah gave no return for the benefit he received, because his heart was proud. Therefore, wrath came on him and on Judah and Jerusalem. However, Hezekiah humbled the pride of his heart, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Lord did not come on them in the days of Hezekiah. We ask the question, is there a place in the Kings and Chronicles where it says that God was angry with Hezekiah, threatened him, and Hezekiah repented and God relented? Yes, right here. So this is an amazing little piece, I think, of Bible detective work. It's like one of these undesigned scriptural coincidences that you have a little bit over here in Chronicles, you have a little bit over here in Jeremiah, 100 years later, that explain to us the full context of Micah chapter 3. I think that this adds an enormous dimension to our appreciation of still A-plus Hezekiah. Still A-plus Hezekiah was able maybe to rest on his laurels a bit. And think of what Paul says about, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. The conclusion for these passages is well nigh inescapable. That Micah 3 took place at the end of Hezekiah's reign, after all the acts of faith and after all the blessings of God, that only then was it that Hezekiah's heart was lifted up. Remember Jotham, of his father Uzziah, it says, when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction. For he transgressed against the Lord his God and went into the temple of the Lord to burn incense. So it would seem to have been, apparently, in the case of Hezekiah, that this good man, this decent king, this wonderful leader, having known God's blessings, been confident in them, and that confidence turned into complacency. And it explains for us, when we come back to Micah chapter 3, it explains to us what's meant when the people say in verse 11, is not the Lord in our midst? No evil can come upon us. This was after the Assyrian thing. Can you imagine what it was like living through that siege with all those Assyrians there, with the reputation the Assyrians had? They were known for their absolute cruelty. They used it as a policy tool to be cruel, physically cruel. People were terrified, and God delivered them. An angel went out and destroyed 185,000 of them in one night. Is not the Lord among us? For sure God was. What a sobering exhortation then. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So I want us to wrap up this session by taking a minute to think about ourselves as brothers and sisters in Christ. We're privileged by the fellowship we share. I'm privileged to have you brethren and you sisters to encourage me in the right way. We're privileged to have our Bibles and to be familiar with them. We're privileged to know the truth. I've had friends that they've come to understand how God is and how he deals with us, how he punishes wickedness and how who used to believe that they would be tortured forever for their sins, who have been relieved of a heavy burden of misconception. The truth is beautiful. The earth is not going to be destroyed. It's going to be filled with God's glory. We're privileged to know these things. And so let's not rest on our laurels. Let's not say to ourselves, is not the Lord among us? None evil can come upon us. We have to remember our God is a consuming fire. Now we're going to see a bunch of passages where he is reaching out to the poor and the oppressed among the people and offering them hope. And that hope is ours as well. The exhortation there that we have to take. Paul says, behold the goodness and the severity of God. We've got to put it all together and to be so grateful for the abundant mercy that he shows us. And final thing I want to say is, look at Hezekiah's humility. That when rebuked by Micah, the prophet, he repented. And God relented. Because as we will see tomorrow, God is a God who delights in mercy, who will subdue our iniquities and cast them into the depths of the sea.